I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Seth Frantzman, the op-ed editor of the Jerusalem Post, who has just returned from the front lines of the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot and an early good yontif for the festival of Simchat Torah. This is a time of joy for Jews. We're celebrating Sukkot, which is actually my personal favorite Jewish festival because of the outdoor quality of it, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and its central theme of gratitude, which underlies so much of what is good about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot must have been the time when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing their own agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, but enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops when they were doing the harvest. It was a time of great joy and celebration, of food, drink, and conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot is the time when you're commanded to invite guests into your own sukkah, which reflects on the structure of the sukkah itself. It is usually open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the four species with which we celebrate the festival, the palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, which symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah called Asukkele by the oddly named group Suki and Ding.
Asikele a kleine vom Breitalach gemeine hab ich mir asikele gemacht badektem dach mit a bissel es Sitz ich mir in Sikkele Bana Badektem da Mit a bissel es chach Sitz ich mir in Sikkele Bana Doch die Spalten in die lächterlich sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch. In die lächterlich sei brennen ganz still.
That was the pretty song Asukkele for the holiday of booths this week. By the way, in Europe, they had homes, some of them, that were built with a room with a retractable roof so that it could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs had to have some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside the house. But it speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday and to being Jewishly observant that whole homes were designed in Europe with the sukkah used only 8 days a year in mind. It's also true that some of us only use our living rooms or formal dining rooms about that often, when we have guests over, of course. Speaking of guests, on Sukkot, we symbolically welcome our ancestors to join us in our sukkah, our homemade tabernacle. These guests are called Ushpizin, exalted guests, and they include the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and King David. A nice group. More egalitarian streams of Judaism, like my own Reform Judaism, also welcome the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and biblical figures like Miriam and Deborah, too. I invite to my meal the exalted guests, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David. May it please you, Abraham, my exalted guest, that all the other exalted guests dwell with me and with you. On each day, a different one of these seven magical guests, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David, complete the roster. So, even though we're near the end of Sukkot now, it's still good to invite guests, real and imaginary, for this holiday, and share in the joy of a season of true gratitude. When we come back on Sukkot in a few moments, we'll meet our guest this morning, Seth Frantzman, the op-ed page editor of the Jerusalem Post, who has just returned from the front lines of the Syrian, Afghan, Iraqi refugee crisis in Greece, Serbia, and Hungary. Find out what it's like to cross the borders of Europe right now, on foot, meet the refugees, and hear their stories and their reasons for participating in this largest human crisis since World War II. And meet Seth Frantzman when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501, a fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice. Because every day counts.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, an old friend. Seth Frantzman is the op-ed editor for the Jerusalem Post and recently wrote about some extensive experience he had in Europe among the refugees in that huge crisis there. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish, and it's good to talk to you again, Seth.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You have followed this refugee story over to where it's all happening. Tell us a little bit about how this assignment began and how you ended up doing it.
Well, I guess a few weeks ago, around early September or so, I was, this news kind of broke, and we started seeing all these images of refugees and this crisis. And it's a crisis that I think many of us, knew about over the years. I mean, we had known about all this, many African immigrants who were drowning in the Mediterranean, and even the phenomenon of many people coming to these Greek islands. But I think this was kind of galvanized by this image of this young Kurdish boy who was drowned. He actually drowned on a beach in Turkey, but he was trying to get to Greece. And I had a lot of friends, actually, or some friends that I had worked with in the past as opinion, who had written opinion for me, who were Syrians who were living in Istanbul. And so I was aware of the, you know, story of these people, but all of a sudden, you know, there was a huge crisis. And I thought, wait a second, I'm sitting here living in Jerusalem. Why am I not there? Why not just get a plane ticket, fly to Greece, and let's see what happens? Why not try to find a way to cover this, basically? And you know, my wife, we just had a kid at the time, and I tried to convince her to say, listen, let me go away for a kind of 4 or 5 day weekend, and let's see what we can do, what I can do over there.
What did you find? Where did you go? How did you decide how to start? I mean, it's obviously a huge issue.
The first thing was trying to figure out what's the best way to cover this. And first of all, I discussed with our new editor, you know what, maybe I'll go to a Greek island, and you know, we can sit on the beach and see the people come in and meet them when they arrive, and maybe work with one of these organizations that's giving out aid and sit with them in the tents and then see how they're processed and try to understand here are these people setting foot in the EU and what are their hopes and dreams and kind of where they come from and why they decided to make this journey. And it just seemed logistically there was no way to get to Lesbos or some of the islands, because these islands, which might have a local population of 10 or 30,000 people, some of them have 30,000 or 100,000 refugees coming onto them. So, like, It was already immediately apparent you cannot really get a plane or a ferry there, because half the plane services have been suspended. The ferry services are full of all these refugees, and it's just very difficult. So what I looked at was, okay, you know what? The other way to do this is, let's try to follow the refugees north. We'll start in Thessaloniki, which is Greece's second largest city. We'll take the train with the refugees, because they're all basically using the rail links. We'll go to the border. We'll cross the border. Then we'll head north through Macedonia and Serbia and all the way to the border of Hungary, because in that time, before the Hungarians had closed the border, but all of them were basically going through Hungary. So logistically, the biggest hurdle we crossed was trying to figure out where to rent a car. Most Greek rental agencies didn't want to give us a car because, I don't know, for whatever reason, but the Greeks view Serbia and Macedonia as some sort of like wild country. So they're like, they didn't want to give us cars, even though you think, well, can't you just rent it's an EU country and it has insurance. What's the big deal? But that was a big pain. You know, finally, we got figured out how to get a car. I got the plane tickets, and I was alone, but I drove up to the border, and the thing was, you think, okay, the way you see this in the media is, well, it's just this huge tidal wave of people, but then you get off the plane, and you're driving on the streets of Greece, there's no refugees. I mean, it looks like Greece is supposed to look, which is Greece itself is having a huge financial crisis, so whatever poverty you're seeing is basically a Greek issue. And then when you get to the border of Greece and Macedonia, all of a sudden, it's all very in your face. And you realize, you come to a small village, and all you see is all these people carrying little backpacks or with their children walking. And you realize, okay, well, this is all these refugees. And you come to a bridge, and you see thousands of people stuck on a bridge. And then you understand very quickly, okay, this is what everyone is talking about. This is the thousands and thousands of people that are crossing the borders every day. And all of it being done basically kind of semi-legally. And that, I think, was the first thing that was striking.
Wild. And we will continue to explore the dimensions of this problem, including what the responses are, what the various responses of the natives, people living right there are to the refugees. When we come back in a few moments with Seth Franzman here on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, KohanAward.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18, T-O-O, JewishRadio18 at gmail.com, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website, TooJewishRadio.com, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as Popular Jewish Podcasts. We have a little over 13 months until we elect a new president of the United States. We continue our special election year plus feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. In-depth coverage, unusual stories, and the finest Jewish opinion on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. How much does money matter in the current presidential contest? Well, so far, not much, at least in terms of who has spent the most on TV ads. According to the latest ad spending data, former governor of Florida Jeb Bush's campaign and his super PAC have spent a combined $5.4 million on TV ads so far, followed by almost $5 million by Ohio Governor John Kasich's campaign and a little over $4 million by Hillary Clinton's team. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie have shelled out nearly $3 million each on TV ads. But that money has not translated to surges in the polls. Meanwhile, the fastest rising candidates, GOP frontrunner Donald Trump and Jewish Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, who has made a considerable cut into Hillary Clinton's national lead in the latest polls, have spent $0 on TV ads. That's right, zero, none, garnished. Trump has the most money of anyone in the race, but he so far hasn't spent it, relying instead on his ability to entertain the media and garner huge amounts of free publicity. And Sanders? He has become a national phenomenon on the basis of his down-to-earth Jewish guy from Brooklyn persona. Is this a great country or what? That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat, Chag Sameach.
Boker Tov and Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
So lots of happy things this time of year. Something not so happy. The Iran deal was a foregone conclusion to me from the beginning. But one of the interesting after effects and painful ones is the separation, perhaps, between the Israeli public and the American Jewish public on this important issue. In England, when you're about to get on a train that says, mind the gap, there's a gap now, isn't there?
Yes, there is a gap. But the good news that I really trust that we will mind the gap.
We will mind the gap, yeah, and narrow the gap.
Yeah, I really, really hope. And actually, I trust that we will mind the gap, because the relationship between, you know, the people of Israel and the people of United States are strong. And I believe that it will take some time, but the Israeli will feel again the same trust that he used to feel always, that America is our, you know, is the Israel biggest ally, an important one, for many, many, you know, for decades, and will still and will remain But I can't ignore the feeling among the Israelis that, you know, that this divisive agreement created a huge gap between, you know, the leadership, between even in the feeling among the Israelis, you know, the just the Israelis, that, you know, it's very surprising that 60, and there is people that say that 80%, 80% of the Israelis, I feel that it's more 60%, were against this agreement, like, you know, from Bibi to Herzog and everything in the middle. Just, you know,
from right to left, yeah, all across the only, middle, everybody.
Only the Arab League were the Arab coalition were, you know,
in favor out, of the
in favor.
Iran agreement, right.
But so I think it was a overwhelming majority against the agreement. And the feeling that the Americans that usually will stand along, you know, and betach vebetach, for sure, when you have this majority. So it was, you can feel it because there is so a big majority in Israel that against it. And the Jewish voice in America was all over, and also the American voice was all over. And the leaders were, of course, in favor. So it creates a feeling that you can't ignore it. Just a divisive, I think. I don't know if it's the first time, but...
It's probably not the first time, but it's the... there were times during the Lebanon War, even going back that far, in which there were differences between the American Jewish community and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this one certainly highlighted some fissures, some breaks between, even within the American Jewish community, mm-hmm. on this issue, but between the general American Jewish population and the Israeli. So going forward, what are some ways that we can see that American Jews and Israeli Jews will come back together? What are issues that will bring us closer together? I know it's a harder question than what brings us apart.
It's a good question for Sukkot. Sometimes we just need to give time.
Right.
For people to experience that maybe the next future will be better even with the agreement. Well, we're not a prophet. And you know, Bibi will be here in November. Hopefully the relationship will be better. Between
the prime minister and the president?
Hopefully. Yeah, let's, you know.
Doesn't seem like it could get too much worse. Hopefully this improves.
You know,
it.
Jewish people have only one thing. Do you want to guess?
Tikva.
Hope. Yeah.
I knew
that's
you would
it.
Say that.
Yeah. So let's be, you know, let's wish that
I think
will be better.
It's a good thing to wish on Sukkot. Sukkot is actually the most messianic of all of our holidays. We read lots of Haftarot about the end of days and judgment bringing us to peace. Maybe we'll find a way after a time to come to that.
Nachon.
Thanks, Oshrat. Chag
Sameach. Chag Sameach.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the refugee crisis, all of the Syrian and Iraqi and Afghanistanian and North African refugees pouring into Europe. Last week, we talked about both how Turkey had handled them. By the way, Jordan has done as well as it could possibly have done, I think, in a very difficult circumstance. Lebanon, in a way, as well. Greece has been pretty good about passing on refugees and treating them humanely. Now let's talk about what happens after they cross over and the challenges that's posing for the European Union.
Right. The European Union is one case, but before we leave the Middle East entirely, we should at least raise the question of why the really rich countries, the Arab countries in the Middle East, like the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, don't do more.
Qatar,
they import basically sweatshop labor from Pakistan and Sri Lanka and India and Thailand and the Philippines. Why don't they send those people home and take in their fellow Arabs and give them jobs and homes? There is housing, there is employment, there's work
oil
for these people to do.
And they have oil.
And these Arab refugees are not as foreign or as alien in another Arab country as they would be in Denmark or Holland or Germany.
I mean, both culturally, linguistically, religiously, they would fit far better there, you would think.
Right. So, I mean, an interesting question to be explored at another time is, why aren't those countries doing more? Why aren't they stepping up to welcome their Arab brethren? But then the question, with all these horrifying images of people
I have to interject. I mean, and the assumption is they don't want to destabilize their own regimes, and they're concerned that bringing in people who might feel like they could stay would cause them problems because they're all autocratic regimes.
Well, that's a judgment call. I'm not sure they're all equally autocratic.
Not equally autocratic.
Right. Some of those countries are less than fully participatory democracies. The only ones of those in the Middle East really are Israel and Turkey. And also, it's fair to point out that traditionally there's no love lost between Turks and Arabs. Neither group likes the other at all. But the Turks have been very humane and very decent about all this. There is starting to be rising prejudice in Istanbul, in a big city, in that every crime, every pickpocketing, every nasty incident is blamed on Syrian refugees, the way it used to be blamed on Albanians or gypsies or some other minority.
Some other minority.
Now, whoever does something sketchy or questionable or petty criminality, whatever, it's got to be the Syrian refugees. But anyway, that's neither here nor there as we look at the bigger problem of, you know, people being herded into camps and numbers being printed onto arms and horrible scenes that are reminiscent of some aspects of Central Europe's past. Hungary, of course, has sort of a neo-fascist prime minister, and the Hungarians have essentially closed their borders. So somebody who wants to move from Southeastern Europe to Germany or Austria can no longer do so through Hungary. The Germans have instituted border controls at road and rail crossings between Austria and Germany, which were technically abolished under the Schengen Agreement. Europe in some ways is reverting to its old nationalistic self. And the question is, why? And is there hope for a different outcome? And I think both of those questions, the why and is there hope for a different outcome, are worth exploring next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you're interested in going on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Masada to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One final leftover joke from the High Holy Days that we so recently completed. Toward the end of Yom Kippur, the rabbi asks his congregation, "How many of you have forgiven your enemies? Raise your hands." And they do. Maybe 90% hold up their hands. The rabbi repeats the question, "How many of you have forgiven your enemies? Raise your hands." Everybody responds this time, except one man, a very old man named Goldberg, who comes to shul twice a year maybe, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. "Mr. Goldberg, it's good to see you here today. Are you not willing to forgive your enemies?" asks the rabbi. "I don't have any," Goldberg replies gruffly. "Mr. Goldberg, that's very unusual. How old are you?" "I'm 98 years old," he replies. The congregation oohs and ahs. 98 years old. "Okay, Mr. Goldberg, would you please come down to the front of the shul and tell us, how can a person live 98 years and not have a single enemy in the world?" The old man totters down the aisle using his cane, stops in front of the pulpit, turns around, faces the congregation, and says, "I've outlived all the momsers." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, in fact, tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m., we celebrate Simchat Torah, the wonderful festival, when we finish reading the Torah and start all over again at the very beginning. Breishit, Genesis, a very good place to start. Genesis, Breishit, the very first Torah portion of the year, presents a challenge for any commentator. There is so much to say. Where do you start? Which is, of course, precisely the point, for Genesis is the beginning not only of the Torah, but of Judaism and all Western religion, including Christianity and Islam. It starts with the great theological creation of Breishit and the immortal eternal words, Breishit bara Elohim, in the beginning. God created. Those words are instantly recognizable, more famous than nearly any other phrase in religious literature, but this celebrated commencement is actually a problem. You see, the Hebrew in the word breishit actually means at the beginning of, in a grammatical form called smichut, attached, and it must be followed by a noun, always. Yet here, at the very start of the beginning of the holiest, most ancient text in our tradition or almost anyone, it is followed instead by a verb, bara, created. That is, the first two words of the Torah don't agree. Very Jewish indeed. There is a grammatical error in the absolutely first place it could possibly occur in the whole Bible, which is, of course, not only our Jewish Bible, but the very first text for Christianity and Islam and all of Western civilization. So what might this mistaken phrase mean? Commentators throughout history have engaged the question. Perhaps it means at the beginning of time God created, or maybe at the beginning of God's creation of the universe God created. Perhaps it means at the beginning of the world God created, or, well, you can come up with your own fix for this grammatical problem. But why don't we just correct it? Well, all traditional associations aside, we have had this text unchanged for at least 2,000 years, as the Dead Sea Scrolls prove. Who are we to change the Torah? But there's a simple explanation that opens up the entire process of Jewish study, of Torah, of being an active Jew in a wonderful way. You see, if the very first words of Genesis require us to think and interact with the text, every passage of Torah must therefore be open to interpretation. That means that we instantly become partners with God in the creation of Torah in every generation. Each of us must create her or his own understanding of Torah, must make it meaningful to him or herself. Every one of us has to insert ourselves into this incredible book, find our own way. In the spaces between the words, each of us must create our own midrash, our own interpretation of Judaism that will bring meaning and holiness to our lives. It is a remarkable invitation. Breshit bara Elohim, at the beginning of Torah, God created this process of what we might call midrash, and so invited us as partners to think, learn, teach, to embrace our Judaism in an active way. This is really what Torah means, interactive learning, finding God through using the excellent minds we have been given, exploring what a great text can mean in our lives. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from the story of Adam and Eve in this week's portion, but in the famous Chapter 2, the Garden of Eden section, it's by the poet Stanley Barkan. Oh, to be Adam again, with all his ribs, yearning for a woman as yet unborn, mouth free of the taste of apples, ears without the hiss of snakes, mindless of nakedness and shame in the garden of gentle creatures, waiting for a name. That's the poem As Yet Unborn by Stanley Barkan. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest Seth Franzman will tell us what it's like to be present on the borders and among the Syrian and other refugees seeking to find a place in Europe today. Find out what the front lines of this massive human crisis are like when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a speech at the United Nations Palestinian Authority, President Mahmoud Abbas said that the Palestinians are no longer bound by agreements with Israel, although he did not outline any plans specifically to abrogate them. We declare that as long as Israel refuses to commit to the agreement signed with us, which renders us an authority without real powers, and as long as Israel refuses to cease settlement activities and to release the fourth group of Palestinian murderous terrorists, prisoners, in accordance with our agreements, they leave us no choice but to insist that we will not remain the only ones committed to the implementation of those agreements, Abbas said in an address at the opening of the annual UN General Assembly. We therefore declare that we cannot continue to be bound by these agreements and that Israel must assume all of its responsibilities as an occupying power. Abbas did not say when or how the Palestinians would withdraw from the agreements, nor did he say he would dissolve the Palestinian Authority, which is a product of the 1993 Oslo Accords and gives him his international standing. We will start the implementation of this declaration by all peaceful and legal means, he said. The most far-reaching withdrawal would involve the Palestinian Authority pulling out of governing the most populous areas of the West Bank and ceasing cooperation with Israeli security forces. Abbas sought to revive talks towards two separate nations, implicitly rejecting one-state solutions advanced by some in the Israeli government and by the more radical and insane Palestinian groups. I say to our neighbors, the Israeli people, that peace is in your interest, our interest, and the interest of our future generations, he told the world body. That certainly is true. Abbas pledged to continue to seek state recognition in international bodies, something Israel and the U.S. oppose, unless there is already direct talks. Abbas pledged to continue to seek state recognition in international bodies, something Israel and the U.S. oppose, without direct peace talks leading to that kind of work. Abbas also accused Netanyahu's government of colluding with Jewish extremists who seek to stake a claim to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, holiest site in the world for Jews, sacred as well to Muslims. It has been under the control of the Waqf, the Muslim religious authority, since Israel allowed the Waqf to remain in that role in 1967. I call on the Israeli government, before it is too late, to cease its use of brutal force to impose its plans to undermine the Islamic and Christian sanctities in Jerusalem, particularly its actions at Al-Aqsa Mosque, Abbas said. This, of course, is completely disingenuous. Netanyahu says Israel is observing the status quo, which it is, and blames Abbas for inciting recent violence in Jerusalem, which his statement certainly won't help. Abu Mazen's speech was deceitful and encourages incitement and lawlessness in the Middle East, Netanyahu said, using Abbas's nom de guerre from his days as a Palestinian terrorist. The day of Abbas's speech in the UN was the first time the UN raised the Palestinian flag, a move strongly opposed by Israel and the U.S.
The West has always been a place where a man went to prove himself. This spirit has been captured in Chaps, the cologne by Ralph Lauren. Chaps isn't just for men who ride horses. It's for men everywhere who are strong and proud, who are living their lives with a feeling of independence.
After 48 years, Ralph Lauren, the man behind the quintessential goyish look in American fashion, is stepping down. Lauren surprised many when he announced he is bowing out as CEO of Ralph Lauren Corp. His hand-picked choice, Stefan Larsson, will replace him. Larsson is 41. He made his name as part of the H&M clothing team that expanded swiftly in the U.S. Then he took over as president of Gap's Old Navy branch. Lauren will stay on as the company's executive chairman and chief creative officer, but as he said, when they start designing things I can't understand, I'll quit. Now might be the time. Who knows? Born Ralph Lifshitz to Jewish immigrant parents from Pinsk, the Bronx-born Lauren, who will celebrate his 76th birthday next week, became known as the man who dresses America. Lauren's iconic styles brought cowboy chic to every department store, plaid into every closet, and his polo brand, with its iconic man on the horse with a mallet logo on the shirt, has made the preppy look obligatory for American college kids for decades. Ralph Lauren himself, of course, was far from a preppy. He went to a Jewish day school and the Marcia Stern Talmudical Academy before going to DeWitt Clinton High School in New York and then dropping out of Baruch College after 2 years. Well, he has done all right for himself ever since. And four American Jews have been named John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Fellows out of the 24 geniuses named last week. Princeton University historian Marina Rustow, novelist Ben Lerner, healthcare entrepreneur Gary Cohen, and New York-based visual artist Nicole Eisenman each received the Genius Grant, so-called, of $625,000 with no strings attached. Mazel tov. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
Our brother,
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Seth Frantzman, who has recently returned from investigating and writing about the refugee problem in Europe, the greatest refugee crisis since the end of World War II. You describe seeing the mobs of people, maybe not mobs isn't the right term, but just this sort of flood of people trying to cross. This is kind of a dumb question, but Turkey has a land bridge to Europe. Why are so many people going by boat? Do you know?
Yeah, I interviewed some of it's interesting, the refugee crisis is mixed. Something like 70-80% of them are Syrians, and many of the Syrians are from Aleppo. And about another component is about 20%, which is mostly Afghans and some others. But I interviewed a lot of them as I could, and some of them said, well, you know what? We didn't come from Greece. We came from Turkey through Bulgaria and Romania or other ways. So there is a land route. What I understood was it's much more difficult to cross. And I guess there's some fortifications or people will be, I guess maybe the Bulgarian government is not as welcoming. And, you know, but the way these things happen is once one guy gets there and is successful, and of course the idea is, well, let's, you know, his cousins say, okay, well, let's do that. And then he tells all his friends. So I think what happened in Turkey is, you know, there's a lot of people involved in facilitating this. So there's people selling life preservers. There's people selling these people rafts. And the friends I spoke to in Istanbul said, look, in the old days, you know, you could pay $10,000 and the traffickers would get you across in Bulgaria in the back of a refrigerated truck. And actually, we know what happened with some of those cases because some of these people actually died, suffocated to death in the back of some of these trucks. So what happened is over time, the price went down to about $1,000 to get you across into Greece. And so we have to remember there's an economy that lives off of this. So there are traffickers that are involved in facilitating this. And right before I went to Europe, I was in touch with a family of Syrians that were in Istanbul, and they said, listen, we're going to be leaving tomorrow night, you know? And I said, and I was in touch with them on WhatsApp of all things. I said, okay, so when you get to Greece, you know, we'll WhatsApp next time, and you'll tell me if you made it. I mean, which is kind of shocking. But these people all have cell phones, and there's a modern technology involved. So I think there's economics play a big role in why the Greek thing became more the chosen destination. And I think we see now with the closing of the border of Hungary that, you know, this is all very malleable. So the day after the border with Hungary was closed, all of these buses started rerouting to Croatia. I mean, this is a very smart network. And these people are middle-class and educated people, many of them. And they know very quickly, okay, that's not going to work. Let's go.
You know, the Syrian civil war has been going on now for several years. There have been enormous numbers of refugees for years in camps in Jordan and southeastern Turkey. I saw one of those camps not too far from where I was in southeastern Turkey in February. They said there were 500,000 people there. What's the composition of the group that's coming to Europe? Some people said, obviously we've seen pictures of drowned women and children, but there's other reports saying, oh, it's all men, and this is some kind of a planned exodus. What was your experience of them?
What I saw was about 60 to 70% men, and then the rest being women and children. But definitely children were a big component of it. I would say with the Afghans, although I gave a ride to a few female Afghan women, but I would say with the Afghans, there's more men. But with the Syrians, it seems to be a lot of families. So in the extended family, it might be five men and, you know, one or two women and three or four children or something. So there's definitely a lot of children. But I think this is the most shocking part, because you see these people and they're changing diapers while walking on the railroad tracks. And then, you know, you just think, well, how could you make this journey with these young kids? I mean, and you can see all the stuff that they've purchased for the journey, which is even more shocking. It looks like people that just went in and raided like a camping store in America and just bought whatever the cheapest camping equipment they could buy was, and because they're basically sleeping out. But most of these people basically think, look, we'll sleep out a few nights, and eventually we'll get to Germany, and this will kind of work itself out. So I think that definitely men are the majority, or younger men. I saw very few older people, let's say. There's a lot of children and a certain percentage of women.
What was the attitude of the local people? Greeks seem to be receptive, knowing that most of the people are just passing right through. How about in Croatia or in Hungary and other places that you visited?
So I was in Macedonia and Serbia, basically, and then I was in Hungary briefly. So
right, sorry.
I would say that the feeling on the, you know, what happens is most of the country is untouched by this migration. It's primarily just these border towns that are, that basically have thousands of people. We're talking 5,000 to 7,000 crossing a day. So in some of these border towns, the population is only 20,000. So you're talking one in four people is basically a refugee. So you can understand that these people feel like they're kind of being totally invaded, although they understand as, look, these people are poor and they don't want to stay here. So as long as we can facilitate them moving on, it's fine. So there's kind of a begrudging understanding, but I think there's also resentment that builds up. Like, I was in a Macedonian town where, you know, these refugees would just plop themselves down in someone's front yard and start eating there. Or I saw one case where they plopped themselves down in an old train station and just started a fire in the middle of the train station. And you can understand, look, I mean, if you're a local person, you're like, well, that's not very respectful. I mean, why are you treating us like this? So it's kind of mixed. You see some local people that are really friendly, and they even give them advice. They say, listen, if you go this way, you'll get there faster. If you go this way, you won't. You see people that make a business off of them. Like, I saw a lot of Roma, or what is usually called gypsies, basically selling lots of, like, water and cigarettes to the people. So it's kind of a mixed response. But I think, as you said, as long as they keep moving, the response is, that's fine. We don't mind to have you here. But I think when it becomes a burden on the local community, the people are not exactly happy. And for instance, I saw one restaurant owner who basically left to choose to eat his restaurant. He said, no, I'm closed. And then I wanted to go there to eat. He said, no, it's fine, you can come in. So I thought, you know, I mean, there is a low-level kind of racism of feeling that, look, we don't want those people. But as long as they keep moving, I think the feeling is that's fine. Just keep getting on the buses and keep going.
And their goals are, and you talked to some of the refugees, what I've heard is people want to go to Germany, they want to go to Holland, they want to go to Sweden. How did they decide those are their destinations?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mystery. I understood that Turkey has a long relationship with Germany.
That's true, right?
Most people know that most countries in Europe have a relationship with their former colonies, or for whatever other reasons. So like with England, you have a lot of Africans that want to go there because they speak English. France, for instance, have all these Moroccans. Now, Germany traditionally had Turkish laborers that were coming to Germany, and Germany had a close relationship with Turkey during the war. So in the old days, lots of Kurds and lots of Turks went to Germany. So I understand it makes sense that Syrians, having moved to Turkey, then use the same networks to get to Germany. But what I also understand is that these people, you know, they hear from their friends, well, Finland is a good choice, or Sweden. And that can change on a dime. So like Denmark, for instance, which was seen as a place people could go, suddenly people said, oh, no, Denmark's not good. They're racist. There's been protests. So I think all that can change overnight. But I basically, the understanding of the refugees tends to be the richer northern European countries in Scandinavia is basically the best place to end up.
Seth, you know, a final question, having been over there and seen this kind of overwhelming refugee situation. People are talking about, well, they're terrorists hidden in among the refugees. Seems to me there's much easier ways to get terrorists into Europe than send them in a group of 27,000 people a day walking. Did you see any signs of other stuff going on there?
Oh, there's definitely a sign that you know, that there's Islamic charities or whatever involved in giving these people food or whatever, but as far as I could tell, the refugees, I never saw any of them stop to pray. I didn't see people with beards that looked like they just got back from fighting with ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra. I think people who talk about terrorism and spread these rumors, I think that they should remind themselves that there are 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 members of ISIS who came from Europe and including Russia to fight with ISIS. So if there are quote-unquote terrorists who are coming to Europe, they're basically coming back where they were from. I mean, that guy, Jihad Johnny or whatever, was from England. So, like, it's not true that these people are potential terrorists. I mean, there are potential ISIS members in Europe today, but they didn't come from Syria. I mean, most of these people are really victims who have lived for 2 years suffering in Turkey. And they can never go back to Syria because they can see the writing on the wall with the Iran deal and Putin's, Russia's involvement in Syria, that Syria will never be home for them again. and they have to choose their feet, that they have to find a new life for their family.
I want to thank Seth Frantzman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your work?
If you Google like Seth J. Frantzman and J. Post or Jerusalem Post, you'll find the 3 or 4 articles I wrote. And there's also, if you look on YouTube, there's a video I did, basically a short 15-minute documentary about the work I did there, and you can find all that.
Seth, thanks so much, and Chag Sameach, a happy holiday.
Chag Sameach.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Mark Hetfield, President and CEO of HIAS, the most significant Jewish refugee agency in the world, describing what has led to the current crisis and what to do about finding real solutions. Our playout here on Too Jewish comes for the upcoming Festival of Simchat Torah tomorrow night. It's the fun, upbeat Klezmer Freilach, The Rabbi Rejoices by Hanan Barsala. May you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot today, Shemini Atzeret tomorrow, and Simchat Torah tomorrow night and Tuesday, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a week, we pray, of joy and peace.